it's time to listen to the interviews from Island Life on Saturday the 13th of December 2014. Island Life is Waiheke Radio's weekly look at Waiheke people, events and issues. It's brought to you every Saturday morning from 10 till 12 by the Humble Pie Village Butchery. You'll find them at 102 Oceanview Road, Onirua. On Saturday the 13th of December, David Basham talked to Greg Deans from the Jazzy Dean Trust, recent winner of a Kiwibank Local Hero Community Award. And he talked to local board chair, Paul Walden.
And we've got Greg Deen in. Greg Deen. That's right, it is Greg Deen. Sorry, I just had one of those mornings where everything seems to have been a bit messy, and I just thought I got your name wrong for a second.
Good morning.
So Greg Deen will be well known to most people as the chairperson of the Jazzy Dean Trust and the founder, I assume.
And yes, that's right.
Greg's here because he received a Community Hero Award in the city the other week.
Yeah, it was very, very nice to be acknowledged for the work that the Jazzy Dean Trust's been doing for the last 22 years. And it was very nice. I felt in excellent company with Billy Jordan and Russell Deleu. Who are both definitely heroes, in my opinion, and so it was very nice to receive the award from Mayor Len and Kiwibank. Really, it's very nice to get an award, but at the end of the day, the success of the Jazzy Dean Trust is a result of the support from the community. So, really, it's the community's award, and over the years, there's been a lot of money raised for sick children, and there's been very much every year the need for children to be supported when there's a medical condition or an illness or sickness or an accident. It doesn't get any less. It just keeps going and going and going, and as parents of children know, kids get sick, so it's nice to be able to provide a bit of support for the families when that happens. So
yeah,
it's quite a privilege to be in a position to help, to be frank, yeah.
And it's not cheap.
It's not cheap. I mean, there are families that, in my own instance, for example, when Jassy died in 1992, we were both good job, and we owned our own home, and we weren't on the poverty line or anything like that, but we were still a hard-working middle-class family, and we didn't have a lot of money to waste, and we had to watch our things. We had to be quite frugal in many respects, especially family of four children. And so then the realization was that, after Jassy died and I felt like it was necessary for myself, I wanted to make some sense out of it, was a recognition that when a child is sick or has an accident or there's a family illness that preventing a family from, looking after itself, you don't have to be rich or poor to need help, or that help will be fine, useful, and help with medical expenses and transport. And it's very nice to have established something which is a permanent part of this community which supports our children. It's great.
And how did the money start out? Where did the first lot of money come from when you first started?
Well, we first started with sausage sizzles. Tony Pope down at Mitre 10, as it was in those days, donated the barbecue to us. And so we went down there every Saturday morning to outside Mitre 10 and sold sausages. I think they were a dollar each in those days. We'd make $50 or $60 every week, and we had fundraising dances. And, the money was very slow coming in when you're making it in like that. So the first few years, we ended up raising maybe $2,000 or $3,000 a year, which we gave back to the community. And then we decided that we'd produce a calendar. So we produced a Waiheke Island calendar for 4 or 5 years. That was extremely hard work with producing the calendar and then marketing the calendar and then selling the calendar and then managing the, all of that was very, very time-consuming for us. That worked out quite well. So that was probably, you know, I don't know, our income maybe went up to $7,000 or $8,000 a year or something like that, which again, which we put back into the community for kids. And then, of course, in 14 years ago or 15 years ago, we made the decision to establish the Garden Safari.
That was a stroke of genius.
Well, it turns out you're correct. Yes, it was. It was it was an initiative that was resulted from many discussions from the trustees. I don't know that we had a lot of money at the time. We were finding it quite hard to, you know, the thing is that we could only give away what we had, and we always felt that there was a more need than what we could supply. And so, yeah, from small beginnings, Chris Palmer, who was a trustee at the time, made the suggestion. He was talking to some of the other trustees, and then it started. And I think the first year of the Garden Safari, we might have made, I don't know, a couple of $1,000s. And then it's just gone on from strength to strength till, you know, this year, the last few years, we've had, you know, our turnover's been over $100,000 a year. And,
wow.
You know, that's, of course, that's our turnover. That's we have to take a lot of expenses out of that to bring back down to our to our actual profit. But that amount of money, you know, I think over the years we've probably raised $500,000 or $600,000
so that's, for the community. That's money. It's good money, isn't it?
It's great money
for everything. And of course, it's popular. I mean, people from I've got friends from town that come over every year. I mean, they come up. A lot of people come from town because they want to. No, nothing better than having a look at someone else's place. And I remember somebody who was a little grumpy said, "Yeah, they come and they look through the windows, but everyone wants to have a look."
They do. It's true. And you know, we're blessed on Waiheke Island with having not only fantastic landscapes and seascapes and you know, locations in incredible places, but the generosity of people that have got resources and have got beautiful homes to allow people, you know, there's a couple of thousand people traipsing through their front gate over that weekend, and you know, it's a big contribution, and they're beautiful homes. And yes, people, I was only in Auckland a few days ago, in fact, and someone overheard me say that I was from Waiheke Island, and they said, "Oh, Waiheke Island, oh yes, we've loved the Garden Festival, we've heard all about it, and I went down to Taranaki last time, and next year we're going up to Waiheke." And I said, "Oh yeah, great, come on over, have a good time."
Yep, that's the way.
That's our challenge, to be perfectly frank. We find that every year it becomes harder and harder and harder with the Garden Safari. There's only so many gardens on Waiheke, and after 14 years of 12, anything between 12 and 20 gardens, that's a lot of gardens, and to replace those every year and keep it fresh, and also to keep it fresh for people that are visiting. You know, people come to the Garden Safari year after year after year, and I think, oh gosh, you know, I was here last year and there was that garden in it last year, and you know, the gardens this year, I thought they were better last year, and blah blah blah. So it's our challenge to keep it exciting and fresh and vibrant and wonderful for people. And we, you know, that is, you know, we are dependent on the generosity of Waihikians to open their gardens and to create their gardens. It's a significant effort. So I'd like to, you know, encourage people to give us their gardens, help our kids, and create an environment on Waiheke Island that people want to come to. I mean, not that people don't want to come to Waiheke. It's a wonderful place. But, you know, Waiheke itself is a garden. It's a beautiful garden. And to have their beautiful locations and gardens open for people is great. So, you know, we need to get more people to come to the event and look to the mainland. Waiheke, I don't think that we can get too many more people coming from Waiheke. And those that have been coming over the years are kind of thinking, oh, yeah, I've been five times. So I don't really need to go again. And so we have to encourage them to come back with new ideas and new things.
Yeah. So is that obviously is the main way you raise the money. Do you
it's
have any other
–
it's the only way.
It's the only way.
I mean it's big enough. I mean,
it's a huge,
lot of – because you'd be planning the next one as soon as the last one finished.
It involves well over 100 people to organise the event. And we have a committee of – I think there's eight people, key people that are on the management of the weekend event. So it's not just the safari, it's the weekend event. We have the art auction, the garden safari, the sundowner drinks, and the plant sale.
That plant sale is popular, isn't it?
Plant sale is amazing. Yep. I mean, people come along to that plant sale. There's landscapers, contractors that come and buy their plants for, you know, throughout the year at Nio Lewis's, where she's wonderful. Nio is over there in Onitangi, and she plants and propagates and all year for the event. So does Rolf Hatcher, and they, you know, they sell plants throughout the year for these. So it's not just for the plant sale, it's actually ongoing. And of course, the thing is about this is that the amount of work and effort that goes into it's all voluntary. There's, you know, people aren't paid to do this. This is something they do out of love of their community and willingness to support our children. We do have a paid coordinator, but to be perfectly frank, if we counted up the amount of hours that she worked for what she gets paid, she's probably getting paid 10 cents an hour. And for that, she does a wonderful – that's not quite true. She's she does a great job, but, you know, we're not in a position to be able to pay what the job deserves. And so our wonderful, wonderful safari weekend coordinator, Michelle Barber, She's you know, without her, we'd be quite lost. And she's the only one that's paid. And the rest of the people that are on the committees are doing it for free and for love.
And you've got to earn your own living. I mean, you can't be you can't be doing it all the time. So it is a bit of a strain. I've been on a few things over the years, and you know that does well. Even the radio here, you know, we've got people with young kids and jobs and everything, and it does take up it can be
I've got two jobs. I think I've got two. Well, actually, might have three, to be honest. But, the Jassy Dean Trust. Again, we share the load. There's seven trustees that manage the Jassy Dean Trust, and we all have various responsibilities and duties. But we're all volunteers, and most of us have got careers and work that we have to, you know, survive and support ourselves. It's kind of good, you know. What else do you do with your time? If we could be fishing or swimming or boating or golfing or something like that.
Or sit around watching television.
But you know, and we do all of those things. But for the most part, we spend a bit of time on helping others, and it's a very satisfying thing to do. And I've my own experience over the years, I've realized that doing things that specifically for myself, while can be satisfying, ultimately not particularly fulfilling. But in doing something for someone else, although to do so requires sacrifice, it is very fulfilling, and it's a very strengthening, and I feel good about myself because I help others, and it's just nice to know that there are, you know, it's a warm fuzzy feeling when someone comes up to me in the street or gives me a hug in the supermarket and says, "Hey, Greg, you know, thanks for the ticket, or thanks for the cash that you gave us, or thanks for helping out." And so I straight away get on the phone or email to the other trustees, "Hey, you know, I just ran into so-and-so, and they just give me a big hug in the supermarket." You know, that hug's for all of us.
No, it's important because if that feedback doesn't come, it can feel quite isolated, I should imagine. But it's a good feel of,
it is a
of
good
doing. But it is nice to know that it's not just the thanks, it's to know it's really made some difference.
That's the point. It is the point. That's dead right. It's not the thanks. And to be perfectly honest, there is not a lot of thanks. It doesn't trouble us because we know what we're doing makes a difference in people's lives. And we sort of sit around at our meeting, we have a couple of glasses of wine, and we thank each other. Because just to acknowledge that we are actually doing some stuff that is helping other people.
Well, there's certainly people like me who know what you do from my own family, and
thank you.
I think it's just stunning. There's one thing that really I know it really amazes me, and I know about those envelopes that are available.
Mm.
Would you like to talk about the envelopes
that
are available?
That resulted from when we rushed to hospital with Jassy. Our doctor, Ian Scott, gave my wife, Bron, some cash and shot her down to the ferry and or helicopter and got her to town. And that cash was quite useful for us. And so when we were thinking about ways in which we could provide support, the basic thing which we decided then and which we've continued for all of these years is what we call the emergency envelope, which contains $50 cash and a ferry ticket and some important contact phone numbers, social welfare, the Wake Health Trust, doctors, health professionals. You know, an acknowledgement that, you know, you don't have to be in a medical emergency, but you might, you know, if your child's got a broken leg or suddenly got some weird ailment that you rush into the doctor and you forget your purse or forget your wallet and you get there and you've got no ferry ticket, no cash, the health professionals can hand over that envelope. It just means it's a little bit of a emergency backup for when you get to town and, you know, someone's hungry or need a drink or you need a taxi and the ferry ticket gets you there. They're great. They're very, very, very much our backbone of support to the community. And, you know, with respect to that, just want to acknowledge Fuller's through George Hudson in the early days of the trust and his, you know, personal support for myself and my family and of the trust. He came to me and he said, anything you want, Greg, just ask, we'll give it to you. And for 22 years, we've never been turned down for a ferry ticket. Mm-hmm. And that's a sponsored ticket.
So they are absolutely amazing.
They're wonderful.
People do criticise Fuller's for all, but people don't really know of all the things that Fuller's do.
Yeah.
I've experienced them on a whole lot of things.
Yeah.
And those envelopes, I know someone who is around when they're given out sometimes, and they said the tears that people have in their eyes when they suddenly are given this. Because sometimes they haven't got anything.
Right.
And they, you know, I mean, sometimes they're just, I've got to go home. No, you don't. Here, you've got this. But for some people, it's just to have that money when they're in the city. Because it's, you know, somebody wants something.
I do. They do. And, I mean, you're stuck in town.
Kids want things, and it's not simple.
Yeah.
But they said the number of people who just, she said she's seen them hand it to people who just burst into tears with the generosity. So they do work.
It is very humbling to know that, it's not a bad thing to give a helping hand when it's needed.
No, and you do some other bigger things too. You go to families and help them with projects. What kind of things do you work on?
You know, the funny thing,
I mean, I can talk about it, but the best come from you.
Well, you know, the one of the biggest challenges is, you know, like, coming from the new world, one of the new world countries, you know, Australia, New Zealand, Canada, you know, South Africa, and you know, the countries that aren't the ancient countries of old. Our pioneer spirit means that we have a very independent nature and we stand on our own two feet and we bring our children up to be independent and not dependent on others. And it's part of our tradition, a part of our culture to actually not to ask for help. And, you know, and I think it's particularly prevalent here in New Zealand, where, you know, seems to be a reluctance to ask to help. And this is one of the things that we have to work against, because there are people in our community who are very deserving of help and are shy about asking for it. And we'd like to encourage people to come to the Jassy Dean Trust when their children are sick or have a medical condition of some sort or have had an accident. And because there's an awful number of, there's a hell of a lot of people in this community that are working very hard to have a fund which is available to families, and the money's there. And we've got a nice little cash sum in the bank that is available for anybody with a sick child. So we do encourage people to put their hands up. Things that we do, I mean, there's a number of families on the island that have children with chronic illnesses. Possibly some of those children, some of those children have got some severe disabilities. So we'll provide assistance for medical equipment. Sometimes it goes to the point where families are stressed beyond, stressed out because the child is constantly demanding, has got some severe disabilities. So we can support the parents to have a bit of time out, just to have a break.
And I'm aware of that one with the Jazzy Dean Trust because it's something I got involved in. And people think, oh, well, it's just for them to go on a holiday or something. But if the parents aren't good, if the carers aren't good, then the kid isn't good.
That's right.
The child isn't good. It's not just...
Well, the quality of care...
You can't just keep on giving all the time. Even though you be a loving, caring parent, you can't just give. There's a breaking point.
Well, you're absolutely right, and more than that too. It's that you know the quality of your support is that much better if you've got a bit of time out, and B, if you've got support from someone. Jazzy Dean Trust comes along and says, "Hey, look, you've been working really hard for the last 2 years with this child, which is constantly demanding of your time and your personal resources. Here's a couple hundred dollars, and you go and have a night out in town, and you come back the next day and you feel good. You say, "Hey, that's great," and suddenly you don't feel like bashing that kid over the head, it's stressful. I mean, we're all parents; we know what it's like when you get pushed beyond your limits. Mm. And in those times, it gets hard. Yeah. You're right. It's not just support for the children; it's also support for the families.
Because a happy parent leads to the happy child. Because some are solo mothers, and there is nobody else. And 10 o'clock, 11 o'clock at night, when there's no one to really turn to,
well, it's very hard.
Pretty hard, dark time.
When you're looking at your child, and you see your child has a chronic disability and are struggling every day of their life just to maintain any standard of living, and you're experiencing that on a day to day basis, 24/7, it takes an exceptional person to remain positive and cope in those circumstances. And let's face it, most of us are not exceptional. We're just ordinary people doing the best that we can. And we want to support those ordinary people doing the best that they can.
And no one said to us, "Here, you're going to have this on your plate.
Gosh, no.
Get ready for it, because this and we're not trained for it.
No.
And it is hard, and that's where the Jazzy Dean Trust, I know, I do know,
yes,
that the number of things that you have really supported people in. And I remember it was a small, I think it was a hair, it was a hairdresser, and it was something else and something else, and it was just like the response of that person was just overwhelming, because they, it was just something that they couldn't imagine doing, because they wouldn't do it,
right,
because they'd feel like they shouldn't, but they got this gift, and it just boosted them enormously. They even had someone look after the child for a day while they went and had all the things.
Nice.
And it's those things that that person is then feels like they do matter. Because it must be hard sometimes to just feel like, well,
it is
no,
terribly
I
hard.
Don't matter,
Yeah, that I don't matter, and also that I'm alone.
Mm.
I'm just doing this on my own, by myself, and that's that. Those feelings are make it very hard to be positive and confident about doing everything. And that's needed.
Money doesn't go as far as people think it does.
Money doesn't go very far at all. But I'm just reminded sometimes that of a story that I heard a few years ago about releasing the Jewish prisoners from the death camps, the concentration camps, Auschwitz, etc., after the Second World War. And the general in charge of reparations of these people, and they were suffering, and they'd been deprived of every human thing possible for years, and they were skeletons and living dead, really horrible conditions that they'd suffered. And the general, found that some bright spark in back home had to support these people, had sent cases and cases of lipstick for the woman. And he was completely shocked. He's thinking, these people are bloody starving, and what the hell did I need with lipstick? And this is a stupid thing. Anyway, the lipstick was duly distributed. And suddenly the women who wore lipstick felt human again. They were smiling because they were given something to make them feel that they were alive. And it was one of the most positive and wonderful things that could have been given to them. It was far more important than food or sustenance. Mm. It was a belief in themselves that they were actually still alive. And I sometimes think about that when support's asked for, from families where their children have got, some illness and they're struggling. And I think to myself, yes, provide support for medical equipment, for drugs, for helping out around the family where there's shortfalls. But also look at beyond those things, beyond the things that make people feel a little bit more human, a little bit less alone, and have a little bit more confidence in the day-to-day life.
Because you would have to offer that, because nobody would ask.
No one's
going to say, oh, my hair needs doing or something. They're not going to say that.
No.
I mean, they struggle to even ask you for the obvious thing.
Yes.
But they're not going to ask you for that. But the fact you give it.
And
I know some people you've given it to.
People don't think about it.
It's amazing.
It's again, where you have, thank you. Thank you. And thank you on behalf of the other trustees. It's amazing when we completely focused on we've got a child that's ill. Our focus is on making that child's illness less severe or getting over it, improving it, healing. We don't focus on anything else. So it's nice to get some. It's a little bonus, and it's a good thing.
I was having a coffee. My friend Brendan runs a coffee cart at down on the Causeway, and he must have been somewhere. I just don't remember. And there was a lot of people from the. Oh no, there was at the market. A lot of people were on the garden safari, and they asked about the Jazzy Dean Trust, and I explained it to them.
Oh, thank you.
And they were, they were renewed by the whole thought. It wasn't just some trust that it was sort of, they weren't sure. And does it do good? And is it doing this? And, it wasn't hard to explain it. I knew it all. Well, I didn't know all of it, but I knew a lot of it. And I was able, and they were really delighted to hear how wonderful it was on the island. And those little envelopes, I mentioned those.
Good.
But they haven't, I hear about those because of the connections, and it's just wonderful to have all that, because it is hard. I mean, it's not easy with kids.
Well, our challenge is to keep the work of the trust in the public eye, in the community, so that the community is aware of it. We have a ever changing population on Waiheke Island. People come and go, and that's our challenge. I have to admit that we are not amazingly. We're not good at publicising what we do. We try to let the community know that we're out there and we're there to help, and help's available and that support is there. It's something we do. I mean, we're fortunate in that we are a community resource, and those people that have been in the community for some time are aware of what the Jazzy Dean Trust does. So we do have a word of mouth. Very powerful word of mouth, letting everyone know what we do. But we need to balance our, it's very easy to get involved in printing costs and marketing costs and publicity costs and advertising and things like that, because that's taking away money from children.
Yep.
And so we need to balance that. And we've also never applied for public funding. We've always been self-funded or community funded by our fundraising efforts. because we find that we could go down that path, and in many respects we probably may in the future, but it means that we have to provide so much time, effort and energy to make these applications. The bureaucratic world is a nightmare of time. And so it's almost like to get funding for something, you can't expect a volunteer to do it. You need to employ someone. So you're employing someone to get funding, and the funding pays for the employment. What's the point?
Yeah, I know what it's like managing a charitable trust for mental health. It's not simple.
No,
you do have to apply for a whole lot. What's the future for the Jesse Dean Trust? Will the garden safari keep going? I mean, do you see that as the
well? Yes, we do. We try to bring new elements to the weekend. We call it our safari weekend now, because there's four. As a result of the success this year's weekend event, we've introduced the sundowner drinks, and so that's the evening, the Saturday evening of the safari. We have an extra garden, which has opened up, and people go and wander through that garden and stay there until sunset and have some cocktails and some food and some music. And so it becomes a little party garden for the Saturday evening.
Right.
And so that proved to be extremely popular this year. So we'll grow that in the future.
Right. So that's good. So you're just adding things into
that's
it.
Right.
As you say, you need to provide something new.
We need to keep it fresh. Yeah. We need to keep it exciting. Right. And so, yeah, the future of the trust is, I'm hoping that we can continue with the success of the Safari Weekend, and we're planning on continuing that success. We'd like to do what we do better. We are limited by our volunteer philosophy, that we don't want to be spending the money that we raise on paying people to do things. It just seems to be. But, you know, the world that we live in means that that may have to go down that path. We may need to be nice to have a sponsor. Be nice to have someone that says, look, you know, I hear that your administration needs getting to be a bit of a burden. Our family would like to offer you $50,000 a year to sponsor you on your good work, or $20,000 a year, or $10,000 a year, or $1,000 a year. It would be nice to see the Jesse Dean Trust established as a permanent feature of the Waiheke community future landscape. One which could administer and run itself without the need for the trustees. Something perhaps, you know, we're all getting older. I don't see myself not being involved in a Jesse Dean Trust in the future. But it is a big task for some of the supporters that we have. The other trustees working very hard. People have been on the trust for 20 years, 15 years, 10 years. The future will be what we create it to be, and we're not going anywhere. We're here for the long haul.
Ah, I wondered what I was looking for. Some music. It's all right.
That was my phone.
Yeah,
I'm sorry.
It's all right. I was looking for it. I was a bit puzzled as to where it was coming from. Mm. Yeah. Well, thank you very much for coming
great.
In,
it's
and
pleasure.
Congratulations on your award. And it does give. I mean, it's for you, and you have put a lot of work in personally. But it also does raise the publicity,
yes,
and I think that's important, and it can show an acknowledgement. So when you do look for funding, if you do, they like to see. I know the funders like to see acknowledgement,
right?
And I think it's easy to get the funding if you're doing a whole lot yourself. Mm. They don't like seeing people who are just sitting back and doing nothing, or nothing, that's not fair, but you know what I mean. If you were just going, we need money for this, but you've got the safari weekend, you put a lot of work into that, you've got the award, it all adds up when the time comes to ask somebody for something.
It's, I can't emphasize enough that the seven trustees that are on the Jesse Dean Trust are wonderful people, and have been working very hard for many, many years, and We've got new trustees that are coming on. Some of us are getting a little older, so we're introducing younger people into the trust. And, of course, with the younger people coming in, we're also fortunate enough that we're moving into the digital future. Mm. So some of us are sort of digital dinosaurs, really. Some of the younger people are up there very switched on with respect to how things work on the internet, mobile phones, websites, social networking, particularly social networking. So, you know, we're actually quite confident about moving into the digital future. And, you know, we hope that we're here to support Waiheke children for many, many years to come. And
I
appreciate coming in this morning, David.
No,
thank you.
Thank you very much. It was great to see you.
You're listening to Waiheke Radio, 88.3 and 107.4 FM.
Got the Paul, the chairman of the barefoot chairman. He's come in bare feet. Not very often you get the chairman of the board in here in bare feet.
Outrageous.
Morning, Paul.
Good morning.
Oh, it is outrageous that you don't have shoes on. Well, we were going to talk the other week and we didn't, and there was a couple of topics. First of all, social housing, something that I'm really interested in, and we had a meeting.
Yes.
The other Saturday.
Yes, we did. We had a wonderful meeting last weekend.
There were 60 people, or they somebody said.
Yeah, remarkable. So it was a early morning, Saturday morning meeting down at the RSA, 8 o'clock in the morning. So pretty exciting to get such a tremendous turnout of people that are concerned but also feel that they've got value to add.
Bacon and pancakes?
Yes.
But they're just little things. I think a lot of people would have turned up anyway, but it added a little bit.
Yes.
And cups of tea and stuff. But there was a lot of people, I was stunned by the knowledge of some people.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think that's the remarkable thing about our community, isn't it? We've got such a wonderful depth of resource here, and people with passion and energy in all sorts of areas that we struggle to explore. Really exciting, but there was certainly no shortage of people there with experience. A couple of people that have been involved or are involved in doing professional study at university in the whole field of community housing. So really the intent of that first meeting was to have a brainstorming session, really, and map the breadth of the issue that we face, because there's actually a whole pile of issues, and so we very much defined it as community housing. So there'll be elements of social housing that'll address or look at needs for our elders in the community, in the space of rest home care, but also stable housing for families. Housing for patients with health needs, but there's also just the breadth of other issues with existing housing stock that, for whatever reason, is not up to a good standard. So,
well, of course, you've got the history of old batches here, haven't you?
And they can be
pretty cold in the winter.
And that's an interesting, that whole space. I think there's two things to pick up on that. I think on one hand, we do have this history of old batches, which are very small and uninsulated often, and perhaps not as watertight as they might be. But I think also a lot of the conversation moved as to how do we provide for affordable housing into the future. And part of that conversation was around being real about what we need in the size of a house. A number of years ago, I did a bit of a sort of photo essay as part of my building business, looking at, what's the classic Waiheke house. And, of course, most of the old Waiheke houses were very small buildings with big decks and lots of outside space. And I think if you're realistic about this, I think we're beginning to transplant, Auckland-style, urban, great big houses with lots of interior living space. And I don't think we need to. I don't think that's where the answer is for the future on Waiheke. So I think being a bit pragmatic about our needs.
Yeah. I think that would be interesting. And we all sat around and did brainstorming in groups.
Yep.
And I had somebody with me who doesn't work in the housing field.
Yes.
And I just sat there with my mouth open. The amount of stuff that she knew.
Wow.
And the ideas she had.
Really?
It was amazing.
Yeah, no, I had the joy of compiling the information that was put forward on those pieces of paper. And just remarkable, absolutely remarkable.
So what's going to happen with that information?
So we've collated that first up. I think there's two trains of thought. I think very clearly the message that we're, you know, giving to the community as we're bringing people together is that, you know, there is not a department of council or government that's going to solve this problem for us, and as a community we've got to own it.
No, the council's not going to come with a big barge load of money and give it to Waiheke.
So part of the challenge is to make sure that as a community of people that are interested in the issue that we're getting well informed. And so part of the presentation last Saturday was a presentation from a lady who works for Community Housing Aotearoa, which is just an umbrella group for a lot of community housing providers, and so just talking a bit about what they do and what a housing trust might deliver for the community. So I think going forward we'll have some more of that type of presentation, and I'd love to see, I'd actually love to have an opportunity to have a lot of those people that were there on the weekend that are involved in some professional research or study capacity doing a series of very short punchy presentations, and so we can just really begin to inform and get informed as a community as to what the opportunities and the challenges are. Obviously, with the information that we've collected, you know, the end goal of that exercise would be to map out, you know, the various challenges that we face in the housing space, and then work out which ones we can realistically deal with and which ones we can't, and where are the opportunities for today and where are the opportunities for tomorrow. And are there some areas of this that we can get, you know, different groups of people working on? Mm-hmm. So obviously if there's a space that we can get the chaps involved with the community shed and the chapettes involved in, you know, and it might be helping sorting out water tank issues for families or insulation, or it might be just providing support to tap into government and council funding that is available in that space. And so there's a whole lot of awareness of actual sort of funding and subsidies that are available that, I don't know, I just get the sense that we're not tapping into that as well as we could do. And I've sat on the local board for a number of years now, and every quarter we have a report come through from the council, and they've got a retrofit your home scheme where they provide funding for insulation and all sorts of other things, fireplaces and heat pumps to make sure your home's warm and in winter, and there's none of it ever is taken up on Waiheke. And why is that? And what do we need to do to make sure that happens? Yeah. And so there's a whole lot of actual things that we can capture, but I think the big sort of opportunities that's in front of us, it really is in the space that council is looking to offload property around the region to raise money. And obviously there's some council land holdings on the island, and I firmly believe that before we look at disposing of any of those, we should be considering whether they're suitable for community housing. And when I think back and talk to some of those that were involved in the establishment of the Pensioner Housing Village in Ostend, there was a whole science around, you know, when you're having a pensioner housing village, having it in the middle of a village, so there's lots of people around, and there was something that was referred to as the ball over the fence syndrome.
Yeah.
You know, but having elderly that are living in a communal type environment with the ability to have people around and children that might be kicking the ball over the fence, so there's all sorts of other interactions that you wouldn't otherwise get if you were to have a communal sort of housing village that was out in the sort of back blocks.
Yeah.
So there's some council property in Ostend that we're having conversations with council about, but there's also the reality that the government is also in the space of prioritising its efforts in the space of social housing and community housing.
And that's hard to understand.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I've listened to Parliament, because I'm a bit of a parliamentary freak. Watch Sad Old Man, sitting watching my highlight of my night is Question Time when I record it or watch it at 6 o'clock. So I'm a sad old man when it comes to that. My family just shake their heads. But I can enjoy it. Yes. Always have. I've got a brother that enjoys knows it too.
Oh, good.
So there we are.
Yeah.
But what's going to happen if that land was sold?
Yeah.
Would that money stay here or would that be gone?
No, no. So if the council's looking to dispose of land on the island, the money's not staying in the community. So the council's looking to address a funding shortfall for infrastructure associated with new development across the Auckland region, and none of that development's focused on the island, which is a relief. And so, you know, so there's intensive developments that's happening, you know, in South Auckland, up on the North Shore, and so, you know, they're looking to find millions and millions of dollars to pump into that. So, no, we wouldn't see the benefit of the in the community of that those assets being sold. But it is a golden opportunity.
It is.
You know, admittedly, we're getting mixed messages from the government, but what is clear is that they're looking to do things differently in this space. I think if we can get our act together as a community, and I think we can, and I'm very, very encouraged by, you know, the depth of people that was in the room the other day, you know, that there's potential to look at, you know, taking over or buying or whatever the existing pension housing village, but also expanding that with, you know, the potential to develop on some other land that council owns in Ostend. But I think also having, you know, as you spend late nights listening to parliamentary TV, I've spent a bit of my time trawling through the council archives underneath the library. You know, just looking for a historical context around some of our things in the community here, and really blown away by the amount of land that's gifted to council. And I just don't think anyone in their right mind would be gifting land to council in this environment. But I think if we've got a community housing trust that's sitting here that's providing real good benefits to community, I think we're getting into a space that it's, you know, that it's quite viable and it's quite potential. And we, you know, we do live in the most gorgeous community, and the part of that is the generosity of spirit of people. And I think, you know, there's such a myriad of opportunities here.
I think that's what I said. I was talking to Greg before. People are going to give you money. They want to know about your stability. They want to know about what you've done. Do you get money from elsewhere?
If we're
ready, then fine. If we're not ready, the opportunity will just, it'll be too late. And the good thing is, I felt going that day that it was like a hill like this.
Yes.
But I came away not thinking like that.
Yeah.
Because I'm inclined to go, let's do everything.
Yes.
And we're going to have to look at it. But it felt like a real hill climb. And yet it does, I still will be, but it doesn't feel quite like that when you hear other people who have been through it with organisations. So you know the doable.
And that's, you know, there was people in the room that live in our community that are involved and, you know, actively involved in this space, you know, nationally and internationally.
Oh, we had someone who was doing a PhD or a master's or something.
Yeah.
And, I mean, that's all really interesting because it gives you some research that you don't have to go and recreate somewhere else. So what's next step with the social housing?
Well, the next thing is to ensure that we don't have a hill that we can't climb, is that we've focused our energies onto things that we can achieve. So we'll be doing a bit of work. We'll be distributing a mind map, which has got all that information that was collected last weekend over coming days to all the participants, and then we'll be looking to come back in the new year with another series of presentations and a bit of a refinement as to the opportunities that as a board we feel that we can get some best traction on.
Now the other subject I was going to talk to you about when we were going to talk last time was about the old library and the sports park. And I was at the meeting and I must admit it's a little hard to hear.
Oh, really?
You used to have microphones, didn't you, with the other one?
No, we've never had microphones.
Oh, I thought you did because it was much easier to hear. It was quite hard to hear people. But you found the money, is that, I better be careful before I say that. That seemed like was happening.
So we've approved both the old library space and the upgrade to the football club to go ahead.
Because that wasn't what we thought, was it, when we were going to talk?
No, well, it's been a moving feast. So when we came to the last board meeting, the advice that the board had been given for a period of months previous to that, which was that we could, if we were able to find the money, that we could deliver the outcomes at the Aonitangi Sports Park. And then on the eve of the meeting, you know, literally that changed, and they says, "Oh no, you can't." And so that put the board in a very difficult position, and we'd been putting a lot of work in with the football club and the rugby club, obviously working on sort of compromise outcomes to make sure that we can get some outcomes. And so I didn't feel at all comfortable that the board went forward and made a decision without talking with them at least. So we deferred the decision for a fortnight, and we came back and discussed it the other day. And in the interim, we had some good talks with the football club, who said, look, you know, this bureaucratic process of council delivering this project, and you know, the time pressures and this and that, and the next thing, it's just a bit of it's a bit ridiculous, and actually as a club we can deliver this outcome.
You've been listening to the interviews from Island Life, our weekly look at Waiheke people, events and issues, every Saturday morning from 10 till 12, with interviews repeated on Wednesdays at 7 p.m. and Thursdays at 12:30 p.m. Island Life is brought to you by The Village Butchery, the place to go for great cuts of meat and friendly service. You'll find them at 102 Ocean View Road, Onirawa.